This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina playwright, actor, and teacher Sonny Kelly has made it his mission in life to inspire others. He aims to use performance and ministry to connect with people, especially marginalized kids. This purpose ties back to Sonny's older brother, Brent. They butted heads growing up, but Brent was Sonny's role model. The two got closer as they got older, and they both joined the U.S. Air Force. Sonny didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, but that changed when Brent committed suicide at the age of 29. Sonny Kelly is a doctoral candidate in communication at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He joins me in our studio now. Sonny, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Talk about growing up in Southern California, right?
Well, I tell you, it is truly the land of perpetual sunshine. I grew up with very few worries that I remember. Yeah. We were a middle-class family. My father taught high school, and my mother did in-home daycare, and at times she was a homemaker. We had several foster kids coming in and out. So grew up in a family that was very much about giving and not very materialistic at all. So we grew up just enjoying people and each other. And, of course, the weather. I do miss that about California. But I was a little brother. And that was the kind of the bane of my existence, was always being the attachment to other larger units who came before me. My oldest brother, Sean, was the black sheep, so to speak. He was always getting in trouble, so he got a lot of attention. And then my middle brother, Brent, was just an ace. Straight A's at everything. Excellent at everything. And I was just kind of this cute little roly-poly chubby kid who came along, and my problem was that I told the truth a little bit too much, which made me a snitch, see? So if something happened, something broke, they would run into the room, and they'd go straight to Sonny. Sonny, what happened? So my brothers learned quickly that I was a threat to them. So I took it pretty tough.
Well, the other side of this, you said Brent was actually doing pretty well. He's the next one in line just above you in age. So were you always getting compared? Why can't you be like Brent?
No, you know, what's funny is Brent was... My parents looked at Brent almost like he was some kind of supernatural stellar kid. Like, you know, like Clark Kent when he was born into a human household. They're just like, hey, he does amazing things, you know. So they didn't even expect me to live up to that. They were just like, Brent's amazing, but you're cute. So I played the cute card.
And what about your dad? You talked about it not being a materialistic house, but he was busy. He worked a lot.
Yes. My father grew up in segregated South Texas in Aransas Pass, small little town. He grew up in a shrimping family. So since he can remember, he's been shining shoes, pulling out shrimp, working hard with his hands. And so he knew to work. And his father was kind of a hustler. So my grandfather, Snook, was never really around much. So my father always knew, having five sisters and his mother to look after, he had to be, if not the primary breadwinner, a significant one. So his love language, as I've come to learn, is acts of service. So I remember as a kid waking up, my dad would already be gone. You know, I grew up in Santa Ana, California, about an hour south of Los Angeles. My father taught in Compton my whole life. So he'd drive up to Compton, teach, then he'd come back home after coaching, working side jobs, etc. By the time he came back, I was asleep. So I rarely saw my dad except for on weekends, and usually he was either working another job or sleeping. So I grew up kind of resenting him, not realizing that he was showing love by hustling all the time. But it got into me. So I'm always busy perpetually now.
And what about your mom? You were the favorite, I guess.
Huh? I was the favorite. Yeah, my mom is a very light-skinned woman with hazel eyes and what we call in the community good hair, quote unquote. She could pass for white. And so she grew up in Compton, though, in a very black neighborhood. So she was always called that white girl over there. And for her, it was a great stigma. And it really bothered her. And it made her feel ugly growing up. So she always felt like an outsider. And she never wanted her kids to feel like outsiders. So when I was born, I had two big brothers. Sean is 7 years older than me. Brent is 3 years older than me. Both of them lighter skinned guys. And I've learned that I'm really light skinned. My family tells me I'm actually yellow, quote unquote. But I thought I was brown because my mother, when she saw me, she saw a brown baby and she called me her brown bomber. And from the moment she saw me, she realized that I was going to be her favorite because of my complexion. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those times where colorism actually worked in my favor, being the darkest
and
kid.
And in reverse.
And
in
reverse.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it at the time. It's in retrospect, kind of looking at how my family treated me and how we treated each other. Color didn't really matter to anybody in my household that I could tell, except for my mother. And I was her beautiful little brown baby. So she protected me growing up. And she coddled me. She did.
What were their expectations for all of you?
Well, you know, my mother, she barely graduated high school with like a C average, and she's not embarrassed to say that. School was never important to her. She went on to become a dental technician, decided she didn't want to do that, and she realized she loved kids, so she's been working with kids since. My father came through a lot, got a master, was the first to get a degree in his family, got a master's degree, taught at community college and at high school. He's done great things, but he never put a lot of pressure on us. I almost feel like my father was just, you know, there's this famous quote that says, "I am my ancestors' greatest dream," right? I feel like my father has lived that out and he knew it. So he was like, you know what? I want my kids to have the freedom to become whatever they want to become. So it was assumed that we go to college, but ironically, it wasn't because of anything my mother or father said. It was really because Brent, my middle brother, was determined. He was going to be the cream of the crop. And if he was going to college, everybody else should go to college.
And did you find yourself admiring him, trying to follow him, or sort of having to follow him because he's the one?
Oh, just pricked by him my whole life as a child. I found myself annoyed by – I was annoyed into success. And I mean this by saying – when I say that, I mean that Brent was always self-propelled. He would drive toward, you know – art camps and science camps and getting all A's. And so I just looked at him and I was like, man, you know, I can do that too. But I wasn't that competitive until he came. He would come to me and he would just spur me on. For example, one day I came home with all A's and two B's. Decent report card. Well, he looks at it and he says, all A's and two B's? Psh, I got all A's. That's embarrassing. I literally hid my report card from my mother for 2 days. When she got it, she was about to like spank me because she thought something bad had happened. Where's your report card? Everybody has a report card. Where's yours? I show it to her, you know, tail between my legs, and she says, "This is a great report card." And so she finally understood once I told her that my brother had intimidated me, but I was driven to always get A's because I never wanted him to have anything negative to say about me.
So now you're going to go to college. You realize that because he's going to college.
Yes.
Or he's moving on. Now you're trying to figure out how to pay for this, and you're thinking, maybe I'll go to the Air Force Academy, right?
Because of Brent. Again, he went to the Air Force Academy because he wanted to be a pilot. And Brent always did the best of the best. He said, if I'm going to be a pilot, I'm going to be an Air Force pilot. So he went to the Air Force Academy, went and found out that his eyes weren't strong enough to be a pilot, but he'd signed up and he'd never a quitter. And so I thought, well, I want to go to a great school and I want my parents not to have to pay because, you know, my father's a teacher. What are we going to do? And so I called my brother up when he was at the academy. Now, he did 5 years. He went 1 year in the prep school. 4 years in the, so he did the full Monty, so to speak. And I called him up when I was applying for colleges and I said, look, I'm going to go to the Air Force Academy, save mom and dad some money, follow in your footsteps. He said, hey, if you want to go Air Force, that's great, but do not come to the academy. It is painful. It is horrible. He gave me the advice. He said, go do ROTC. Go to a regular college. Get that great experience. Do ROTC. You can still be an officer. School's paid for. Mom and dad don't have the burden. Go for it. And that was a green light for me. I've come to learn that Brent Kelly was not only a hero of mine, but also a great guide through some of my bigger decisions in life. As much as he was my antagonist, he really spurred me on to excellence in some ways I never would have taken on myself, I think.
Well, and that decision then, you decided to go to ROTC. Where did you go?
I went to Stanford University. The Stanford University. I always pause because, Frank, whenever I tell somebody I went to Stanford, they expect me to start saying smart stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm just a regular guy who got into Stanford. Thank God. It went well.
But they don't know how to pluralize cardinal. No, because it's the color now.
It's the color. Right,
yeah,
exactly. People always, it's cardinal, the color.
Got it.
Right? That powerful, powerful red. But ironically, our mascot is a tree. A long story. But we're so complex. We used to have these chants at the football games. We would say, punish them, make them relinquish the ball. Or there's another one I love. Repeated physical blows is all they'll understand. Repeated physical blows is all they'll understand. And it was a bit
No, but you go there. It is a tough place to go, I assume. Maybe it's not all reputation. And you're in ROTC as well, so it's pretty rigorous.
It was tougher than most. I found that coming from a regular public school in Southern California, I was not prepared for the rigors of Stanford. But I had the drive, the heart, and the understanding that it's in me to do the work. So I pulled all-nighters more than the average. I mean, you know, most people pull all-nighters for papers or for tests, but I was always pulling all-nighters because I'd be in classes and kids had already read the Iliad and they'd all already read all these great American and Western classics, and they knew how to break them. And I didn't even know what this stuff was. I had a dictionary next to me, and I was learning words all the time.
Now it turns out their parents were reading them and giving them the Cliff Notes. We didn't know the whole time you thought they were doing it on their own.
Right, but I did the work.
You actually did the work. Hey, you know, let's mention this too, because you were acting, and you had been acting really as a child.
Yeah,
right?
So as a kid, I grew up in Southern California. I'm like an hour south of Los Angeles, and you know, I'd done some little school plays and stuff. But my brother Brent he got the bug one day, and he told my parents, "I want to take acting classes." So they found some acting school for him in Newport Beach, California. He pressured him into paying the bills. He took the class. I mean, within a couple of months, this kid had an agent in Los Angeles. He was going on audition. So he's about 13. I'm 10 at the time, and he starts getting commercials, and I'm getting a little bit jelly, as the kids say. I'm like, and he's making thousands, you know. And so I decide that I want to try it out, and the agent takes me on, and I get my first job at age 12. So I had a couple years of awkwardness, right, just trying to learn the craft, so to speak. And I got a job as an athlete in a Levi's commercial, got my SAG card. So at 12, I'm a Screen Actors Guild,
which means you've got to get, is that, you have to sort of rack up a certain number of hours, or you just
you do. You either have to have so many independent, smaller jobs that rack up, or if you get one big job, like a national commercial with Levi's, you get your card right there. Wow. And so I was wheeling and dealing. At that point, I was getting like a job or two a month. I did a Rice Krispies commercial, KFC. As I got older, I did an episode of Full House, before it was Fuller House, the original, right? Before Aunt Becky was, well, we'll not go there.
No, so, just leave it.
But I did Wonder Years, and so I became a professional actor, and then I got into my high school years, and I realized, oh, I've got to go to college here. And it was between USC and Stanford. And I remember one day walking into my assistant principal's office. She'd called me in there, Miss Maher. Thank you, Miss Maher. And she said, "Sonny, you've only applied for USC. Great school, University of Southern California, but you've got to apply for more. You're capable, et cetera." And she challenged me to apply for one more school. That year, Stanford University had a late application. And so I went ahead and applied. I got in. And a second teacher, I forget his name actually, but he was my chemistry teacher. And he said, "You're more of a USC personality." And that moment, I decided, oh, I'm going to Stanford.
That was Stanford. Made him a Cardinal. And we'll talk more with Sonny Kelly on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Sonny Kelly today, who works to inspire others through his performances and his ministry work. And as a young man, he really didn't know what he wanted to do, had a lot of jobs, stayed busy, but ultimately goes to Stanford and the U.S. military by way of the U.S. Air Force. So talk about that. What were you doing in Stanford? What were you studying? Because you're also going to ROTC at the same time, right?
Right. So I always wanted to be a businessman for some reason. I had this vision of me with a suit and a suitcase. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go to business school at USC, one of the best business schools in Southern California. Stanford only had an economics major, but I'd already committed to going, and I had ROTC paying, and so I'm like, well, I got to do something, so I chose economics. Super boring for me, charts and graphs and cost-benefit analyses. And at the time, I was actually at one of my good friends, Sterling K. Brown, now a famous actor. He was an economics major as well. By sophomore year, he switched over to theater, and I thought, okay, I'll try some acting stuff. Not to follow him per se, but you know, I like what he was doing, and so I auditioned, and I did my first Shakespeare live theater right there at Stanford. I played Christopher Sly in The Taming of a Shrew. It's a part that most people actually cut out. It's a very small, kind of esoteric part. And I loved it. Loved hearing the language, loved performing the language. And I thought, oh, I want to do the stage acting
But
thing.
This is not your introduction to acting, right? You've already been doing commercials.
Always been doing commercials, right? But for me, it was like, package it up, get it in front of a camera, slate, hi, my name is Sonny Kelly. Smile, you know. It was all about the package. It was definitely an outside-in approach to acting that I'd always taken as a kid. So I never loved acting. I loved being, showcased and making money. You know, I was able to pay for my first car. You know, it was nice. Giving loans to my parents, it was cool. And I had good parents. Like, they actually managed my money well. Thank God. Let's just note that. But this was the first time.
You lent your parents money?
It was super cool. You want to talk about empowering? Mom and Dad had to do some additions to the house. I'm like, hey, Sonny, can we borrow some? I'm like, sure, why not? I got it here, I think. I mean, I'm buying comic books at the time. Like, sure, I got thousands.
Right. Okay.
So it was cool.
Different. Shakespeare, obviously, stage acting, totally different thing.
That's when I was really bitten by the bug. When I realized, I saw actors warming up and focusing and finding quote-unquote motivations, right? And then I saw Sterling develop as an actor, and I just really... I just wanted to emulate that meaning-making process, mm-hmm. how powerful it was. And I remember sophomore year, Sterling switched from economics to theater. And I was like, I'm in ROTC. ROTC does not pay for theater majors. So I switched to international relations. And I knew that for international relations, you had to study abroad. So I had one semester in Santiago, Chile, and I told my ROTC commandant of cadets, sir, I have to travel because my major requires it. So they had to let me go. So I missed out on some of the training for a semester, but it was an amazing experience. I became fluent in Spanish, learned people, learned culture in these new and exciting ways. And my focus was economic development in Latin America. So I wanted to go on to be an intelligence officer in the Air Force, kind of be maybe a super spy or an attaché or diplomat, and then move on to maybe work for a non-governmental organization working in development and Latin America especially. That was the goal. Growing up, I grew up with mostly Chicano, Latino, Latinx, Mexican, American people around me. So I knew the language and the culture, and I loved it. It was kind of a part of me. So I wanted to carry on in that passion. I didn't know exactly why, but that was just where I was moving with international relations.
So you had a plan, and now you do have to serve in the Air Force right after out of ROTC. So right. Talk about that.
And so I get out, and I become an intelligence officer, and I've got 4 years to serve of what my brother and I started to term indentured servitude. And kind of tongue-in-cheek, we were resentful about the fact that we had to wear these uniforms and salute people and, like, follow these rules. But we also knew, hey, they pay for
college.
You
know, when you sign up for ROTC,
right, you know.
There's a little bit of it. There's a hint that might happen, right?
There's no surprise. Okay, I mean, you know, it wasn't a public conversation. It's just one of those things like, man, let's get this duty over with. So I will have to say, I didn't join the military just because of a love of country. But I will say I learned to love the duty of it, the discipline, just the hustle. You know, my father was a consummate hustler, and my brother and I took that on. And this whole notion of, like, get up and do what's right because it's the right thing to do, I took to it well. You know, the core values of the Air Force: service before self, excellence in all we do, and integrity in all we do. Those things really resonated with me from my training. So as a child, so when I got into the Air Force, I didn't like intelligence because it was kind of a nerdy sit at a computer, try to know more than the general knows, even though he's watching CNN, and CNN always has, like, that was the bane of my existence. Post 9/11, CNN had embedded journalists everywhere. So I'm sitting there looking at this old news feed, secret news feed, and I'm coming to the general, and he or she is like, right, "We've already seen that."
Because they've got intelligence talking heads on CNN.
Right. They've got, and then of course they've got all the information, and you know they know everything.
Meanwhile, where are you stationed? Where's Brent at this time?
So Brent. This kid, what a charmed career he had. Brent was stationed at L.A. Air Force Base in El Segundo, just a mile away from the L.A. LAX. So he was living in L.A., where we're from, generally, and having a good time. He had trained to be a bartender, so he was a bartending officer. He was an acquisitions officer, so a business kind of job. So he was in L.A., and then I was at San Angelo Air Force Base for 9 months of intelligence training. 9 months where you're learning about weapons and battle planning and all the stuff that never interested me and continues to not interest me. But I signed up for this thing. So I did 9 months there, and then I was stationed at Pope Air Force Base, which is now Pope Army Airfield. At the time, I wanted to see the world. So I put on my dream sheet, I want to go to Asia, Europe, Latin America, of course, Africa, anywhere but here. I want to see the world. Mm-hmm. And then as my last choice, I put, I'll take an East Coast Air Mobility Command base if I can't get these other ones. Well, that was all the Air Force needed to hear. Fort Bragg, Pope
Welcome
Air Force
to
Base.
North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to, and I drove, I remember flying into North Carolina, seeing all these pine trees, thinking, I'm in the sticks. What is this? I'm a city boy. I was resentful. And that's when I picked up the term indentured servitude, to be honest with you. I actually was excited about my Air Force career until I came to Fort Bragg, and I was like, what is this?
Man.
And, I've learned to love it, but at the time I was not
say,
happy.
You need to correct that right now.
No, listen. You know, in the intro, you say I'm a North Carolina playwright and actor. I am. I truly have been adopted by, and I've adopted for myself, Fayetteville, North Carolina, as my hometown. I'm proud to be a North Carolinian. As much as I long for the weather and my people in California, I'm much more of a North Carolinian now.
Yeah. But it took a couple of minutes. And meanwhile, Brent is living the good life in L.A. You're learning to adjust. to life here in North Carolina?
I'm learning to adjust. The first thing I did when I got to North Carolina was I started as an intelligence officer. So we worked in this thing called a SCIF. It's just this cinder block building with no windows, and it's a specially compartmented information facility. So you know, I'm social. You know me. I jazz off of people. I just get sparks from people. Well, I'm in this room with a couple other colleagues, and we're just looking at computers all day researching so we can go and brief a colonel or a general or an air crew for like 5 minutes, and then they leave. So I felt like a little puppy locked into into a kennel all day. But what I did was every time I got off work, I went and I started finding community theater opportunities. So there's a little theater in Fayetteville called the Gilbert Theater, and they used to do this wonderful theater in a backyard. Lynn Pryor was the founder of the theater, and I got cast my first summer in Fayetteville. I got cast as Oberon in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, I told you, at Stanford is where I really learned, ooh, Shakespeare is cool, but I never played a big part. But I'm playing Oberon, you know. I know a place with a wild time, you know. And I'm just like, oh, getting it. And I'm wearing a toga, and I've been working out, so I'm feeling all strong. It's in the garden. And so I thought, man, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be an actor. Oh, but I got to do 4 years in the Air Force. Okay, let me hurry up with this Air Force thing and keep doing community theater. So, like I said, I'm always doing a lot, so I didn't have a problem putting that on my workload. So I would deploy periodically. At the time, it was pre-9/11. I'm that old, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were supporting like stuff in Bosnia, supporting, right. You know, just general operations in Kuwait, et cetera. And I would do theater whenever I could.
Did Cape Fear Theater too?
I didn't do Cape Fear Theater yet. Cape Fear Theater for me at the time was something I wanted to get into, but I think I'd auditioned a time or two. I never got put on there. So I just looked to it as a possibility, but I did a lot of work at the Gilbert Theater, did several Shakespeare shows, a few one acts, and really enjoyed that and decided, hey, I want to be an actor. I remember Brent. I told him I wanted to be an actor, and remember Brent's top of the line excellence. Mm-hmm. He sent me every book that Stanislavski ever wrote. He sent me like the greatest works of Shakespeare, which I still have in my house right now. Mm. Brent actually bought that for me. He's like, if you're going to be an actor, be the best. So he bought me and mailed to me a whole library of acting books, and that's what I wanted to do for the next few years. And so I was trying to find ways to prepare myself so that when I went back to LA, I could get right back into the swing of things.
You said that was pre-9/11, but 9/11 does happen during your hitch.
Yeah.
And talk about the conversation you and Brent had then.
Wow. Well, you know, Brent and I had some tough conversations because we'd come to this place where we were both feeling a bit of angst. You know, I guess most people in their early 20s go through this, but we were feeling there was some depression that we both felt, but he was a bit deeper than me. And we were at this point where we felt like we didn't have a purpose in life. And we were both confused as to what was next. And so I remember we'd had these conversations saying, you know, I hope I get a chance to go downrange, as we call it, you know, and just get deployed and maybe just like die in battle so that mom and dad will be proud of us, but we won't have to deal with the pain of existing anymore. And for me, it was more of a conversation of just I'm confused as to why I'm here. But I didn't realize at the time for him, there was a true deep pain of existence. I'm not qualified to diagnose him, but I think Brent was definitely going through a manic depression. And I say manic because he was the life of the party. I mean, he was electric. He would light up any room. But then at the same time, when he was down, I mean, there was no bringing him up until he got to that place where he chose to or was, you know, able to. And so we would talk about these things at the time. And I remember thinking to myself, well wait a second, Brent, you are my hero. Like, I need you to lift me up. And I found myself as the little brother sometimes trying to cheer him up. And that was where our relationship started to change a little bit in a good way. Like we became much more friends, much more. It became much more of a friendship and a true brotherhood. And I remember one time he came to visit me. And by now he's in Miami. So he did a few years in L.A. Again, I told you, charmed, right? Like Brent spoke things into reality and they happened. So he became a recruiter at the University of Miami, of all places, in a small apartment on Miami Beach. The guy is the life of the party. Well, he comes to visit me just to get away from all the glitz and the glamour, and I'm in Fayetteville, of all places, and he spends a couple days with me, just being with his little brother, and I remember him coming up the tarmac from his airplane and looking at him, and I said, man, you look like Dad. And he's looking at me, and he's also in awe. He says, man, you look like Dad. And it was so cool because we look very different, mm-hmm. but somehow, you know, when you become more masculine and mature, you start to look like your father sometimes. And it was just so cool that we both looked at each other and saw our hero in the other's face.
And that you were somehow had reached a kind of an equilibrium in your relationship.
Yeah, like
as well.
We could talk to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the challenge I have now looking back is that he was crying out for help. He would tell me how he was depressed and how in the military there's a certain stigma if you have any kind of issue that makes you abnormal or quote unquote weak or different, whatever the case may be. So he he would never go to the flight dock and say, hey, look, I'm suffering from depression. So he would share those things with me. And he was taking St. John's wort and trying to like find other, you know, over the counter. But at the time, I didn't know how to deal with it because I'm a little brother, right? How does a little brother give advice to a big brother? And so the challenge for me was just trying to comfort him and figure it out and also deal with my own depression at the time. So I now that I look back on it, I would have been so much more encouraging to him. And I would have let him know you're so not alone. And I will come and visit you when you want to come visit me, when you want me to come visit you. I remember one time, so I visited him in Miami and it was party 24 hours. I mean, I'm talking, they party from when the sun goes down to literally the sun comes up. People are still moving. And that was his element. But I remember when I left, he seemed very sad about me leaving. And I'm not the life of the party. I never was a big drinker, that kind of thing, you know. And I was like, I didn't enhance your time here. Why are you so sad? And I remember he left a voicemail message singing. There's a song by the Tony Rich Project called I'm Missing You. And he sang the song with his horrible, horrible voice. And he sang like the whole song on my voicemail. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant, but that was really him crying out, saying, I was allowed to be myself with you. Yeah. And there's a special thing that happens when you're seen as a hero in somebody's eyes and they love you and they see you for who you are. And I wish I could have that back with you, Sonny. And I didn't realize how powerful an impact I had on his life.
Well, you couldn't. You were the little brother.
I was always looking up.
You can't imagine that he could ever need anything from you. Not at that point.
Exactly. You can't. And he's the guy. I remember as a little kid, there was one time I was like 10 years old and my family's really touchy-feely and my father was leaving somewhere. My brother was playing basketball with his friends and my dad was leaving. I said, hey, daddy, I'll see you later. I kissed my dad on the lips because we're just very affectionate that way. And afterward, my brother was so embarrassed. He said, my friends think you're a girl now. You're not supposed to kiss dad on the lips. My friends feel sorry for you. And at the time he was breaking me down, but I at the same time he was kind of letting me know you represent me and I represent you and you don't, you know, there's certain standards we have here. Those standards I disagree with, of course, but it let me know that what I did mattered. So I grow up knowing that I'm also Brent's, I'm Sonny, but I'm also Brent's little brother. And that means something.
You also at this point, or very, very soon after this, right? Or it's around this time that you meet your future wife, Elaine, right?
Yes. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. That's Bible, y'all. I was in the Air Force, like I said, and not interested at all in wearing this uniform, saluting or being saluted or playing this game. I was like, 4 years, let's get out, go back to L.A. Well, I go to the base chapel, a place I was not interested in going to. I did not frequent. I went to the base chapel for a Black History program, and I don't know why. I just decided, let me check this out. You know, it's February 2002, and I'm sitting there in my battle dress uniform, my BDUs, and I hear this beautiful, I think it's a quartet of singers, singing the song made famous by Mary Mary, I Just Can't Give Up Now. Come too far from where he's brought me from. Nobody told me the road would be easy, but I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me. And at that time, I was thinking about my ancestors and my elders and how much Black people in this country have gone through and how faith has been such an important part of fueling the movement toward resiliency, but also just toward revolution and change and civil rights, et cetera. And it just all just heaped upon me, and I'm tearing up. I'm crying, like streaming down my face. And then this beautiful woman who's singing tenor that day, she was singing really low. I'm like, oh, how's that pretty lady get so low? She walks up and she goes to introduce her uncle, now Bishop John Godbold, Uncle Pastor, we call him. And he was the speaker of the day. And I looked at her and they said, Lieutenant Godbold. Now, in the military, there's this thing called fraternization. Officers are not supposed to spend private time, you know, with enlisted people. Mm-hmm. So most people that I got along with were enlisted, right, which was a no-no. But I'm like, wait a second. This is an officer. I'm an officer. I'm a first lieutenant at the time. And I'm looking at her, and I'm like, she's beautiful. Why have I not seen her? She's got no ring on her finger. My hand goes right to the my eyes go right to the left hand, right? I just, you know, I'm in my 20s. Come on, people.
Yeah, okay.
And she introduces her uncle, and afterward, he gave a beautiful, beautiful, motivational, inspirational talk, and I'm like, wow, this is cool, okay. Afterward, I go up to her, and she's like, hey, Sonny. And I'm like, whoa, 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 why do you know me? Well, I come to find out that I'd met her about a year before this. Just in passing, I was running off to rehearse for a play, I guess, and there was one of those events at the Officers Club, and somebody introduced me to her, and it was typical. Mm. Black officers, we always meet each other and connect because we have this solidarity. And I apparently met her and did not remember. I think that was a God thing because I think she's the most beautiful woman in the world. So I cannot imagine meeting her and not remembering, but she said she met me. And I remember her saying, "Oh, you do plays and stuff, right?" Because a lot of the officers on campus on post had come to my shows, and I said, "Yeah," and I was like, "Okay, cool." Well, a week or two goes by, and I don't know how to get a hold of her. I am working with this program called Find a Friend in Fayetteville, where I'm a mentor and I'm mentoring teenage boys. At this point, I'm starting to find my purpose in life, which is to speak life to people, encourage them, etc. So I'm mentoring these boys, and I wanted to speak to a certain colonel about getting other officers to mentor. Well, mm-hmm. I call him up. Guess who answers the phone? Elena Godbolt. She is his exec for a certain time period. And I'm like, whoa, I'm not losing this opportunity. I've never been one to chase after a person, but I chased after this woman. I try to find any way to keep her on the phone. And then eventually I set up a lunch with her. And so we went to Ruby Tuesdays, matter of fact.
Ooh, how romantical.
How romantical. Right on Skyville Road in lovely Fayetteville.
In Fayetteville. So you talked about it being a God thing, how you maybe forgot, and you quoted scripture just a second ago, but not then. And that, the fact that you only went to that chapel because it was a Black History event, not because it was a God event.
Yeah, I say I wasn't studying God, but God was studying me, is what happened. And I remember having lunch with Elena. She had a salad. She was only eating a salad. And I said, "Are you a vegetarian?" She's like, "No." "Are you vegan?" "No." "Is there some kind of, you know, gluten intolerance?" She's like, "No." And she didn't want to say it, but I kept pressing her because I'm that inquisitive kind of guy. And she said, "Well, my church and I were doing a Daniel fast for 21 days and fasting from meats." And the Bible says Daniel ate no pleasant bread. So I said, "Okay, cool." So I went ahead and had a salad with her. And to this day, apparently that got me lots of points. She was like, "Oh, okay, he's going to join me in this." But for me, it was a turning point, because I'd never seen anybody who changed their eating habits for God. What is that? I knew one young lady, one of my classmates in high school, she honored Ramadan by fasting, and I thought that was very interesting, but I never really dug deeper into that. But Elena was so excited about God and about what God was doing. She spoke about God as if he were alive, doing real things in people's lives, and she was changing her diet for him, and she was, you know, and so I said, okay. So I kept asking her questions, and, you know, she's a beautiful woman. Her father's a pastor, my pastor, Pastor Ron Godbolt and Faye Godbolt at Word of Truth Ministry. Always got give a shout out, you know, we're in the South. But I love them. They're my spiritual parents and my parents-in-law. But she never wanted to push religion, but I asked her so much, I learned a lot from her.
Let's find out what he learned when we take a break and come back and talk with Sonny Kelly, North Carolina playwright, actor, and teacher. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Sonny Kelly today, doctoral candidate in communication at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, playwright and an actor. So you meet Elena, you'd had tough conversations with your brother, Brent. Both of you were suffering probably some form of depression, but now you've got some good news for him, right?
Yeah, I've got some good news for him. So long story short, Elena's like, "Hey, you know, we're different in some ways, and I can't continue to see you." And I was like, wait, what are you talking about? You know, we'd gone on a date and everything. And I was really just smitten with her. And she let me know, you know, faith is important to me, and if you're not of the same faith, it's just not quite going to work out. Well, I asked, I said, "Hey, can I go to church with you on Sunday?" And she was like, "Oh no, please don't. I'm not here in the ministry of dating ministry, or dating evangelism, as they call it." But I was just determined. So she said, "Okay, cool. This is where the church is." I went, and I was just so moved by the Holy Spirit. I felt a call to home. You know, I've been raised going to church. My parents are very faithful Christians, and I'd been baptized at a young age. But at this point, I called on her father to come and just lay hands on me and pray for me. And at that moment, purpose came into my life. And so I had something to say to my brother now. So I would talk to him, and I said, "Hey, I met this girl, but more importantly, I've met God." And he would say, yeah, I know we were raised in the church. I get it. But it would kind of like hit and bounce off, right? And I would just always try to have an encouraging word or a scripture for him. But then again, but still, Frank, I'm his little brother, right? So you gotta honor the hierarchy there, right? There's only so much I could say to him. Well, after 6 months, Elaine and we are so in love. I know it's time. So I propose, and we're going to get married. And I call my brother up and I say, "Hey," so this is September of 2002 now. "Hey, I'm going to get married. I want you to be the best man. I'd be so honored." And he says, "Great, wait, we'll do it in Miami. The bachelor party." I'm like, "Okay, just time out on that. All the drinking and the partying, I don't do that anymore. I'm serving God now." So he's like, no problem. We'll make it work." And I'm like, "Okay, great." Well, October 26th, Elaine and I were in New York. We were going to see Sterling K. Brown in one of his first big opportunities. He was going to be in play with Chaz Palminteri, Al Pacino, John Goodman, and some others. And we were so excited to celebrate him. And I get a call early morning on a Saturday from my mom saying that my brother had taken his own life. and he was in Miami. They found his body in his apartment. And man, that was a moment where I felt like I'd missed my duty station. I felt like I was derelict. There was more I could have said, the more I should have said, you know, to save him, because I knew he was going through this depression. I held back because I was his little brother, right? I was careful in the way that I tried to encourage him. And when I lost him, that was a turning point in my life. It challenged me to never let anybody pass from my presence without feeling thoroughly loved and seen. So I've been told by people that when they're with me, sometimes they feel like they're the only person in the room. Mm. And that's what I want to always do for the rest of my life, because I wish I had just taken a trip to Miami and let Brent know he was the only person in the room that mattered. And I loved him. And more importantly, God loved him, and he had purpose. He was a budding filmmaker. He was just starting to get some traction. But something distracted him, and I'm not sure what it was because I wasn't in the room. But my plan is to always encourage people to know you're good. God has a plan. It's going to work out, and I love you.
And you call that a turning point. But the fact is, you had been working in another direction by then. You'd met Elena. Were you doing youth ministry at the time?
I wasn't doing youth ministry yet, but I was still working with youth. So, you know, I'd been mentoring kids with the Find a Friend program out of Fayetteville Urban Ministry. And I actually, when I got out of the Air Force in 2002, I actually started working for Find a Friend. So I was working in the mentor program, where I was connecting and recruiting adults to be mentors to kids in the community. So it was very fulfilling work, paid nothing, but it didn't matter. It was great work, and it was people work. And so I had been moving in that direction of inspiring and encouraging and engaging other people. But I think now I had even more of a purpose. I had God, you know, guiding me with purpose. And then I also had this notion of, you know, not on my watch again. I'm not going to lose another one on my watch.
Meanwhile, Elena gets a permanent change of station, right? That's in 2003. She goes to San Antonio?
Yes, she gets stationed in San Antonio at Air Force Services headquarters. And I am now in Texas with no job and trying to figure out what to do. I'm Barry Kelly's son. I'm Brent Kelly's little brother. I'm a hustler, and I'm excellent at whatever I do, right? They've trained me. What am I supposed to be doing? I sold shoes on a street corner for a guy that was at our church at the time. It was selling shoes. I got an agent. I started doing little acting bits here and there, little local commercials. I did some voiceover work. I was trying to find whatever I could. Well, St. Mary's University there has a master's degree in communication, and I taught a study skills class at Fayetteville Technical Community College. This is one of my hustles back when I was, you know, when I was in Fayetteville. And I thought, oh, how great would it be to teach? But what can I teach? What am I good at? I speak well. Okay. So I thought I'll get a master's degree in communication. So in 2004, I enrolled in St. Mary's University as a student. And I also found out that if I work at the school, I can get school for free. So I got a job as an admissions counselor or a recruiter. Mm-hmm. And I hustled. I used my bilingual skills. I went to Del Rio. I went to Eagle Pass. I went to Mexico. I went all over the place selling the school to students and their parents. And people loved the fact that I was this anomaly, like this kid from California. I always tell people, no soy Latino, pero soy Latino en la sangre, ¿eh? En el alma mejor, en el alma. It's in my blood. It's in my soul, you know. And so what I did was I was able to really pick up numbers there and do great, but it was exhausting. So I did that for 8 months. And I knew a friend who was in pharmaceutical sales. And I talked to my friends. They were this power couple, James Barnes and Priscilla Barnes. And one worked for Merck. The other one was working for Astellas at the time, I believe. And so they connected me, and I put my application in, and after trying time and time again, I got a job. And so I worked for Pfizer as a pharmaceutical sales rep for 3.5 years and won the top sales award the latter 2 years. Wow. Was doing great, but I came to that point where I was like, this is not what I'm called to do. I love the people. I would, you know, I sold Viagra. So I would walk into the office. I'm the only guy with the audacity to walk into an office with a cowboy hat on and say, doctor, I want your patients to feel like cowboys. How do we do that? I mean, and you're laughing now, right? But I would keep a straight face. That's where the acting continued, right? The bug never left me. So I found I always perform whatever I'm doing, whether I'm teaching or selling medication or whatever it is, I'm always performing.
If you're selling Viagra, you have to keep a straight face.
Bruh, let me tell you, to talk about rigor and I won't even get into it. It's a family show.
We're going to stop that. So now, but now, you're not going to do that anymore. You're getting out of that business. And meanwhile, what brings you back to North Carolina? Because a lot of things are happening.
Yeah, most definitely. So when we were in San Antonio, we also got involved with New Creation Christian Fellowship, where I became a youth pastor. And I transitioned from pharmaceutical sales to being a youth pastor, just called. And it's one of those things where when God calls you, you move and he provides. So literally, I took a 50% pay cut, but I did some wonderful work with the youth there, with Bishop Copeland, David Copeland, and Pastor Claudette Copeland. And I just felt the calling to get out of the four walls after being a youth pastor from 2009 to 2011. And I got a call from Johnny Wilson, who is now the executive director of Fayetteville Urban Ministry. And he said, Sonny, I would never ask you to do this, but I'm going to just put something on the table here. I need somebody to come and run the Find a Friend program. Johnny Wilson was working with the Find a Friend program back in 2003, but now he was running all of urban ministry. And first black director, by the way, of this decades-old countywide ministry. And he said, I'd like you to bring you back. And I thought, that's crazy. That's even a deeper pay cut. He's going to pay me less than what they're paying me as a church youth pastor. What? But, you know, Elena's family's from Fayetteville. My family now is from Fayetteville. This notion of being with extended family, that's one thing I love about the South, is this notion of, you know, family reunions and this connection to roots. And so I prayed about it, and I went and told Elena, and she was like, what are you talking about? We have a life in San Antonio. But she's a great woman. She said, you know, if God's talking to you, then it'll all come together. And as has always been the case, when I feel called by God or we feel called by God, he just provides and the doors open. And everything worked out beautifully. And we ended up coming back to Fayetteville 2012. And I worked for Fayetteville Urban Ministry as the Find a Friend director and the director of operations and programs for another three or so years.
So how do you go from there then to communications and now getting your
doctorate? Well, you know, I've always loved acting. And so when I got back to Fayetteville, one of the first things I did was I got a hold of Cape Fear Regional Theater. And I said, hey, what you got going on? And they were doing a production of Othello. And Tom Quaintance, who was the director of the theater at the time, he cast me as not Othello, but Iago. It was so cool. White man, by the way. I say that just because I love the fact that he took on this burden, this messaging. He was like, you know what? What about the infighting that often happens in black communities, whether it's colorism or whatever, this divide and conquer thing? What if Iago was a jealous black man of another black man? I said, ooh. So we played into that and had tough conversations. And so I played Iago, the toughest role I've ever played. I come to find out Iago has more lines than most other, I think all, perhaps other Shakespearean characters.
Well,
he has so many asides. You know, he's so evil. He's explaining his plot the whole time to the audience. And so I played this supervillain and loved it. And then when I did that, I realized, oh, I love acting again. But just acting with purpose now, not just to go make money, but I want to do something to encourage people. So I did The Parchment Hour in 2013. Mike Wiley, as you know, Mike Wiley's amazing jewel. And in doing The Parchment Hour, I fell in love with this whole process of performance ethnography, like performed ethnography, taking interviews and real history and putting it into theater. And when I did that, Joseph Meagle came down to see the work because he'd worked with Mike, but also Alphonse Nicholson.
At UNC Chapel Hill?
Joseph Meagle, who is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, came down to see the Parchment Hour at Cape Fear Regional Theater. I met him, and I met some of the other UNC folks, and I learned that there was a program where you could get a PhD and actually teach and perform and do what I'd always been loved doing. And, you know, me, add on inspiring and encouraging people. And I will tell you this, Frank, since Stanford, which was the toughest experience of my life up to this point, forget boot camp, forget field training camp, forget anything in the military. Stanford University, being with world-class human beings and trying to keep up with them was tremendously grueling. I was like, I'm not going to school again. Okay, I got my little master's degree at St. Mary's. I'm good. I can moonlight as a teacher at community college. But for the first time ever, I'd considered getting a PhD. And so I applied. I talked to Elena about it, and she was like, babe, just go for it. And I applied and took the GRE, failed miserably at the mathematic part. Like, I was in the lower 50th percentile, but I aced the written part. So the communication department said, hey, we're really just looking at the written part. You're good. I got in, and since 2015, I've been a full-time doctoral student, and my work is really now focused on my purpose, which I've learned over these last few decades, is to perform, but always to perform with purpose, to encourage people, to lift them up, to see them, to love them, and to imagine new possibilities together.
We've talked about The Talk, which is a performance that you did. It's a one-man show, and it had to do with the conversation that you had with your son after the Frederick Gray riots.
And I should say, the talk is the second play I've written. The first play I wrote when I was in the military, and I've performed a few times. It's called The Hope's Light. It's a gospel play that I really fell in love with writing theater that makes a difference. And so I did that, and I thought I was done with it. And then I had this conversation with my son Sterling in 2015. And after I had the conversation with him, I realized, wow, this is a heavy experience, having to explain to this beautiful child the fact that some people in the rest of the world won't see him as beautiful, as excellent, all these things. And so it became an 8-minute short story. And then I shared it with a class that was taught by Joseph Meagle. And he said, babe, Joseph calls everybody babe, you got to do more with this. And so we took an 8-minute story called Sterling Story and made it into an hour and 15-minute piece called The Talk. And it's really getting a lot of traction.
And The Color of Courage is your latest
yes,
project.
Thank
Tell
you.
Us about that.
I'm sorry, you mean to make the mic pop.
It's okay.
Yeah,
Mitch Capel. Robin just fell over.
Sorry about that
Robin's
to all the producers.
Head just blew up.
Mitchell Capel, who is one of my great mentors. I actually met him when I did a show at Cape Fear Regional Theater. We did To Kill a Mockingbird. He played the preacher, and I played Tom Robinson. And Mitch Capel is a jewel. He's a wonderful storyteller. He got me involved with National Association of Black Storytellers and the North Carolina Association of Black Storytellers, something we're both involved in. And he told me early in the game, back in 2003, he said, you're a storyteller. And I was like, no, I'm an actor. He said, no, you're a storyteller. Well, Mitch has been doing this piece called When They Listed. And it's a piece based upon Paul Laurence Dunbar's poetry. And it's about the black soldiers who fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. Well, he had a plan for my life. He said, Sonny, I know I do this piece, but I want it to be a two-man show. And so he brought me in, and we shopped it and talked about it in 2012 or so. And since then, we've developed a two-man show called The Color of Courage. And it brings to life the narratives of 180,000 men who fought in the Union Army literally for freedom. And it's a beautiful piece. It's encouraging, inspiring, but also it's going to be at the Milwaukee Reps Veterans Theater, first annual Veterans Theater Festival hosted by the Feast of Crispian next week.
You're also hosting weekly self-expression workshops at Boomerang Youth Incorporated?
Yes, Boomerang Youth Incorporated. I got to give a shameless plug. Boomerang Youth. .org. It's a program that works with kids in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Orange County schools. And it's an alternative to suspension program. Mm-hmm. That's not all they do. They do a lot of programs, helping kids in the community. But they open their doors 5 days a week throughout the school year to any young person in middle school or high school from those schools who is suspended. So their focus is to keep those kids connected, to build them up, and to inspire them. And what I love about the program is that it acknowledges the fact that the worst thing you want to do to a kid who's getting in trouble is just send them home and release them. You've got to stay connected and stay close. So they're about building positive relationships with positive adults, helping the kids to see the beauty that's within them. And that's where I come in. So Pat Parker, who is the director of the communication department at UNC Chapel Hill, is very community minded. And she sent a message out to all the grad students. Hey, this program called Boomerang is looking for people to do sessions with kids. So I walked in there. I met Tammy Pfeiffer and her team, Sonia Freshmeyer. And I said, okay, let's try something. And they said, okay, well, let's see what you can do. So they tried me out doing a self-expression workshop, and I think I might have had the kids write haikus that day or something. And since then, we can't quit each other. I keep coming every Thursday, and what we do is I pray about it each time. Like, okay, what am I going to teach the kids? And we might do love languages. We might do haiku. We might do role-playing. Whatever it is, whatever that group of, whether it's 2 to 12 kids may need, I meet them where they are. I love them and encourage them, and we find ways to creatively imagine better possibilities for ourselves.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's about first knowing that you can create, not just rewriting your story, but knowing that your story has been written
right
by somebody.
That's why I'm performing.
And that you've got some power over that.
You got that. That's what I love about performance studies. I'm a communication scholar, and I'm all about making meaning with each other, right? That's what communication is about, building bridges and making meaning. Mm. But it's something about performance that takes us into this realm of the liminal, that which is betwixt and between, as it said, right? Where you can start to imagine new possibilities. So my dissertation is called Pipelines to Pathways, Performatively Reframing and Reclaiming Black Youth Identity. Directly countering the school-to-prison pipeline and saying, what if we can imagine pathways, not just the kids, but the whole community, the way we deal with each other, the way we criminalize each other, dehumanize each other, and stop doing that and just imagine new possibilities through theater, performance, poetry, right? The power of creation.
It is a power indeed, and one I'm glad you shared with us, Sonny Kelly. Thank you so much. The time went too fast.
Oh, thank you. So glad. I'll be back.
Sonny Kelly, you're darn right. Sonny Kelly is a doctoral candidate in communication at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Focuses on performance studies, critical race studies, and critical pedagogy. You can find out more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can also sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup. Our show is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robin's back in her seat now after you blew her out of it, but she's doing well now, and I'm Frank Stachow.